Nick DiGilio here. Hi, everybody. We are live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. It is a Monday morning, and that means that we will take a look at the weekend's box office and review the new movies. Colin Suter, Eric Childress from eFilmCritic.com and RogerEbert.com join me every Monday morning to discuss the new movies, review them, and talk about the box office. And that's what we're going to do. So let's welcome Colin. Hello, Colin.
Hello, sir.
And Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Hi. All right. So, by the way, I want you all to know that I want you both to know that that Dan on mentalfloss.com, correct, Dan? Dan Chagrou, my great producer, went to mentalfloss.com and got the 30 best Fast and Furious facts for the ultimate fan. So we will be
all of them already.
We will be yeah, I knew all of them. So we will be peppering this morning's reviews with that.
Thanks, Dan.
My pleasure.
By the way, so it goes in order. They go through each movie, starting with the first one. God, I can't believe the first movie came out in 2001. I can't. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's been 14 years.
These movies have been around almost as long as we've been doing your show.
It's ridiculous. So here's a little fact about the first one, just so you guys know, all right?
Mm-hmm.
It was inspired by a magazine article. I don't know if you guys knew that.
No lie. It was inspired by Point Break.
It was, well, I, okay, yes. No, there's no question.
False fact. We're not doing the other 29.
It says the May 1998 issue of Vibe magazine featured an article by Ken Lee titled Racer X that chronicled illegal street racing in Queens, New York, and the producers optioned that article for the movie adaptation that became The Fast and the Furious.
Oh, my God.
And then they ripped off Cameron and Catherine Bigelow for the rest.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there you go.
I was going to say that article was probably written by Stephen Glass, but no.
There you go. All right. By the way, the movie's title was purchased from legendary B-movie director Roger Corman.
He had dibs on that title? Or?
Well, I think he made a movie called Fast and the Furious. Throughout filming, the movie had been called Redline.
There was another movie called Redline that was about street racing.
Yeah, that's what it says, in which racing is referred to the maximum rate of speed that a car can go. Before the filmmaker settled on calling it The Fast and the Furious, there was only one problem. The title was owned by Roger Corman, who produced a racing movie of the same name in 1955.
So it was called Redline during production?
While they were shooting the first Fast and the Furious, it was called Redline.
Okay.
And then instead of having the filmmakers pay the rights to the name, Corman traded the movie title for some stock footage owned by Universal Studios.
So it's Redline during production. They decide to change it to Fast and Furious, but first have to get permission to Roger Corman.
Who decides that he wants stock footage instead.
Right, which would have might as well. I think John Singleton used some of that for the second one.
Oh, man.
And then so the Redline title became available, and then they used that for the Eddie Griffin film?
I guess, yeah, because that's right. I totally forgot about that movie. God. All right. It's just such a complex world.
Is it?
Sure.
All right. Well, let's talk about the box office. $143.6 million.
Yes.
Furious 7 made. Now, come on now. This is crazy. So these movies get more popular with each installment. Am I not right?
That's the way the numbers go.
Good God. All right. So what did you predict?
I said 140. I said 140.
Yeah. All right. Well, so what let's look back now. You've kind of broke it down in your now. Okay. I have to say this.
Yeah.
The you were talking about the Too Fast, Too Furious, not soon enough. You broke it down.
Right.
In your box office. Man, I don't know about this, the Halloween 3 of the series, referring to Tokyo.
Colin, is that not an appropriate analogy?
That is absolutely inappropriate.
Thank you.
All right, well, that doesn't make it bad, though.
I didn't say it was bad.
Okay.
I was just making a reference that that's what it is. It has almost nothing to do with the rest of the series.
Yeah.
Until now.
Yeah.
But,
until the last one. Until the,
right.
end, the end of the last one.
Right.
All right. So, I guess that makes sense. It's just that I get really upset when people mention Halloween 3, and it's not in a great way.
Hey, no disrespect intended, Stacey Milken forever.
Because I love Halloween 3. And I also...
I sat next to you at the midnight show at the 24-hour thing at the Music Box. Believe me, I know you love Halloween 3.
I also happen to love...
There was not a louder voice of approval in that theater than yours that night.
And I wore my Halloween 3 shirt because I'm a geek.
Yep.
And I also happen to love Tokyo Drift. So I don't know. Well, let's talk about the series itself.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, so when the first one came out, it was a surprise success. Nobody expected it to do as well as it did. And in comparison, it didn't do nearly as well as these others.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it was a word of mouth hit. It was supposed to come out in March of 2001. And then I guess they must've got some good test scores or something. They moved it into the summer slot. And it was a surprise hit.
Yeah.
You know, it did three times the box office that Point Break did several years ago.
Yeah, Point Break bombed, though, man.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
But it was a big hit. And so next thing you know, Cohen and Diesel go off to do Triple X.
Ugh.
Yeah, and it basically leaves this franchise holding a bag with Paul Walker. Singleton takes it over, and Too Fast, Too Furious does fairly well. But no one really likes it.
Right. And then Tokyo Drift comes out.
Right.
Which, how did Tokyo Drift do?
Not well.
No.
Not well at all. No, it did. I mean, the second one did like $125 million, and then Tokyo Drift is $62 million.
All right. And then when they finally reunite everybody for the fourth one.
Right.
That's when the series kind of took off, correct?
Yeah, that's when people showed up as like, oh, we got Diesel and Walker back together, as if that was a big thing.
Yeah.
Apparently it was. So people showed up to that.
Hey, they're family, man.
Mm-hmm. we'll get into that. We're getting to that. So people showed up, and that was the fourth one, was the one that people didn't really like either.
The fourth one and the second one are the two that are the only ones that I'm not crazy about.
Right. Now think about that, people. Nick DiGiulio does not like the second and the fourth Fast and Furious movies. So how good can they be? But then for the fifth one, what do? They bring in The Rock.
Yeah.
They bring in Dwayne Johnson, and that was sort of the beginning of him being inserted in every franchise available. And the thing was a massive hit in this same slot in April.
Yeah. Well, the fifth one rules.
It doesn't. But,
it totally rules.
No.
Dragging that damn safe behind the car.
There's a lot of Tyrese talking in that movie.
Oh, man, that movie rules. All right, so what are we talking about box office for the fifth one? How much did it do?
At the time, it was the biggest April opening of all time. It did $86 million.
Oh, my gosh.
It ended up doing $200 million. At the box office. It was very front-loaded, obviously. It didn't really sustain, but, 86 to 200 million, Universal was going to take that all day.
Right. So. All right, so 86 million, it was the biggest April opening of all time, and this thing opened at 143
million. 143
million. All right, well, let's talk about, what was the sixth one called? Fast Six? Six?
Furious Six, I think.
Was it? I don't even know what the hell, I don't even know what they're called anymore.
Well, if you look at IMDb, it says Fast and Furious Six.
Yeah.
But they actually, if you watch the movie, they actually pull a bait and switch on you. It's actually just called Furious Six.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You're absolutely right. That's right. Okay, well, how much did that thing make?
That one did $238 million.
What did it open with?
In the U.S. It opened around $97 million. And that was just the 3 days over Memorial Day. So the 4 day was like over $100 million.
This thing stomped all of them.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. $143.6 million for Furious 7.
Well, I honestly think that people, you know, I mean, obviously the thing is as popular as it is. So it was going to do very, very well.
Yeah.
But it also has gotten all this extra publicity due to the Paul Walker tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, people, I think that even probably, I bet there are a lot of people that have never seen a Fast and Furious movie before. Ended up going to see this.
Absolutely. I mean, looking at the numbers, I mean, there is, you know, a fan base for these movies, of which I am like the president.
Yeah.
but not for these kind of numbers. I mean, this is the kind of numbers that, don't you think this is the kind of number that the Avengers is going to do? I mean, don't you think it's going to be around?
Well, Avengers is going to be even bigger than this. But I mean, we are talking the ninth highest grossing opening weekend of all time, you know, and that's, I mean, although the top 10 are basically all franchises in some respect, plus the Avengers. So yeah, clearly, you know, the sequel aspect draws people in, but it's still ninth highest all time.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's absolutely crazy. Nobody would predict this. If you go back in time 14 years, when the first movie came out, would anybody predict that this would be a franchise that would make $143 million?
No, I don't think anyone thought it was a franchise past Tokyo Drift. Everyone probably looked at that and went, well, okay, this has run its course.
Yeah.
But then they magically reunited these guys, and all of a sudden it became popular. And you know, I mean, as much crap as I like to give this series, they have gotten progressively a little bit better. throughout time. For you, a lot better. But for me, a little, just inch by inch, they've gotten a little bit more tolerable, and the action sequences have gotten better.
I got to say, I'm still a huge fan of the first one. I love the first Fast and Furious. There are some great action sequences in that movie that I think are beautifully directed. We'll get into it when we review it. But Furious 7... made $143 million over the weekend. I have to tell you, I saw it Friday. Well, obviously, I saw it Friday because, you know, I went immediately when I woke up and saw it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday at the Davis Theater, and it was not packed. But when I was walking out, it was the 4 o'clock show, and the next one was, like, the 7:10 show.
Yeah.
There was a line out the door.
Yeah, so. there was a story. I mean, when you get stories written that suggest that, like, there was, like, a theater in New York, I guess, that had to stay open all night to meet the demand of people going to see this movie. So you get a story like that, and, of course, you know, you end up with a worldwide gross, including what it did here in the U.S., of $384 million.
Wow.
So as of tonight. So you're possibly talking about a $1 billion movie.
That's unbelievable. All right, here's a fun fact about the first movie. Eagle-eyed fans of this movie and Point Break will notice that Dom and Brian visit a restaurant called Neptune's Net about midway through the movie. The real-life restaurant located along Malibu's Pacific Coast Highway is the same restaurant where Lori Petty's character worked in Point Break.
Oh, okay.
All right, you guys, hang on, all right? We'll finish up
more.
By the way, I have facts about every movie in the series.
Good.
Hang on. All right, so Colin and Eric are with me. We're going to come back, finish the box office, and then review the new movies. It's Nick DeGilio on a Monday morning on 720 WGN. Nick DeGilio here. Hi, everybody. Monday morning. And that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews and for the box office, which we are taking a look at right now. Furious 7 just dominated at the box office with $143.6 million. Colin Suter, Eric Childress are joining me to talk about that and more, and we'll review the new movies. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey, by the way, I don't know if you know this, but they used real street racers for most of the race scenes in the first film. Rob Cohen, who visited real illegal street races in preparation of directing the movie, by the way, can also be seen in a small cameo as a pizza delivery guy trying to get through the crowd during the first racing scene. That's Rob Cohen. Enlisted the help of 200 souped-up cars driven by actual illegal street racers for the initial racing scenes of the film. That's why it's a masterpiece.
Fun fact, yeah. Rob Cohen is actually running illegal street races as we speak.
Is that right?
No, I don't know.
Okay, all right, here we go. What's Rob Cohen doing?
Running illegal street races.
No, what was his last movie? Was it that stupid movie with Bradley Cooper that... What was the name of that movie? Remember that movie with the flying with Jessica Biel and...
All Stealth?
Oh.
No, that was Jamie Foxx and Jessica Biel and... Was it Bradley Cooper?
I think it's Bradley Cooper. Or somebody like Bradley Cooper.
It's Josh Lucas.
Okay, sorry. Those guys can be...
Josh Lucas, fun fact, is also running illegal street races.
Was that Cohen's last movie?
I don't think so.
Cohen's last movie came out in January, and that was The Boy Next Door.
That's right. He directed The Boy Next Door. I can't believe I didn't love it. Okay, let's go through the top 10. So we got Furious 7 with $143.6 million. Home with 27.4, bringing up to 95.6. Is that doing okay? Is that...
Yeah, that's basically it's kind of in doing SpongeBob numbers.
Wow. Well, SpongeBob did very good.
SpongeBob did fairly well, yes.
Yeah. All right. And number three is Get Hard, which you two guys like because you're drunk. $12.9 million, bringing its total up to $57 million. Those aren't great numbers for either of those guys.
It's going to do better than Kevin Hart's last movie, and it's kind of on par to do numbers similar to what The Campaign did a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Which is certainly not bad. It's going to be a profit for Warner Brothers.
Okay. Number four, Cinderella, $10.2 million, bringing its total up to $167.2 million. That's a hit, no question about it.
Highest grossing film of the year so far.
Is that right?
Until Wednesday, probably.
Well, until we get more money in for Furious 7.
Yeah, so congratulations, Kenneth Branagh.
Number five, the Divergent series, Insurgent. That's got to be a little disappointing, right?
Yeah, that's probably looking to top out about $125 million, which is $25 million less than the last one did. So
okay, yeah. And how much did it cost?
I think like $95 million, okay. Something like that. Yeah.
Number six, I mean, this has got to be, you know, one of the biggest. I mean, when you look at the circumstances, one of the biggest hits of the year. It follows.
Yeah, biggest hit in the Radius history.
$2.4 million, $8.5 million total. It doesn't sound like a lot of numbers, but you have to look at the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And is it still not an on-demand yet?
No, it's not.
Okay.
No, it's not. Number seven is Woman in Gold, $2 million over the weekend. And I guess that's okay, Ryan Reynolds. I don't know. It just seems weird to me. It's Ryan Reynolds and Helen Mirren.
Ryan Reynolds is doing some interesting work lately. I haven't seen this one yet.
But, I haven't seen it either. I mean, Colin's going to review it.
So. Yeah, but yeah. Only 258 screens. 2 million is not too shabby.
Yeah. Number eight, Kingsman is still on the damn top 10 list. $1.7
million,
$122 million.
And so it'll be on the list next week, too.
I mean, so would this... Are they talking sequel at all for this?
I don't know if they've talked about it. I mean, I don't know if it was a one-off comic or if they did another variation. I mean, it really has very kind of little to do with the actual comic that they made it from. But it's done certainly well enough here. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some talk somewhere because it's done very well worldwide too.
Okay. Number nine, Do You Believe, with $1.5 million. And then number 10, the second best exotic Marigold Hotel with $1 million, bringing its total up to $30 million. Okay. Would you like to know a little fact about the second Fast and Furious movie?
Oh, please.
It's technically the third movie chronologically. A six-minute short film called The Turbocharged Prelude was made in 2003, bridges the gap between the events of the first and second movies. The short shows Paul Walker as O'Connor evading police after the first movie and making his way across the country to Miami, winning countless street races along the way, and actress Minka Kelly, in an uncredited role, stars as the woman who helps him.
Not since Highlander has there been a timeline so convoluted.
winning countless street races in a 15-minute short.
It was 6 minutes.
Six.
Yeah, 6 minutes. Yeah.
He does it very fast, Colin.
It's fast, man. It's fast. Yeah. It's got to be fast
and furious.
How about this one? He went a little. Here's a little fact about Tokyo Drift. The director Justin Lin's first foray into the Fast and Furious saga. He would go on to direct movies 4 through 6. The first movie in which the series to feature new cast members. Lin, who started out small with his 2002 Sundance hit Better Luck Tomorrow, which, by the way, is a terrific movie, went on to direct his first studio movie in 2006 before getting the Tokyo Drift gig. Naturally, many actors in Tokyo Drift appeared in Better Luck Tomorrow and Annapolis. So these are fantastic and informative facts.
Also, a fun fact, the first time Annapolis has been brought up since 2006.
All right. Well, let's get to the movie review, shall we, before we break here. We'll have more Fast and Furious facts coming up here, and we took a look at the box office, but let's take a look at it. Eric, why don't you tell us about last night's?
Okay. Last night, you look at on the surface of this film, you have a movie starring Clive Owen and Morgan Freeman set in some medieval times somewhere, where Clive Owen plays sort of the top dog, top knight to Morgan Freeman's. I don't know. He's in charge of something, and
you're already struggling with the. What's the synopsis of this movie?
Yeah, have you seen the movie, Nick?
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay, well, I've actually prepared something in lieu of this synopsis, because describing this movie is going to bore the hell out of people as much as I was bored as hell watching the thing. So I've actually prepared a little something, a little quick rundown of 10 actual lines of dialogue from the film.
Oh, okay.
That I think that will kind of put the film in perspective.
Okay.
And I'll lead with the longest section of dialogue, which is the opening narration provided by Mr. Morgan Freeman, where he just says, "During the long, dark period of the Great Wars, an elite class of soldier rose from battle. Their unbreakable code was simple: possess a noble heart of courage, right conduct, and absolute devotion to one's master. From out of those years of bloodshed, an empire will emerge. Its power would assimilate persons of every color, creed, and faith, and we shall call it Indiana."
No, what? No, okay, yeah. all right.
Yeah.
Little timely humor there, okay.
Yes. "This uncontested rule eroded the tradition of the great knights, but not for all."
Wow.
That's how the film opens.
And it's
so now here are 9 more pieces of dialogue from the film hopefully, steer people away from this.
Okay.
Number 9, "You are the heir to my spirit." You kind of hear that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
"Welcome, Lord Bartok." Number 7, "The Bartok name will never be forgotten."
Uh-huh.
Number 6, "It's a fine robe. You may also keep the box."
All right.
Number 5, I sold 3 baskets today.
Well, who says that line? It's not Clive Owen, right?
It was not Clive Owen.
I don't see Clive Owen. I don't see Clive Owen selling baskets.
It was Clive Owen's wife, I believe, in the movie.
All right.
Number 4, "We have come for Gizamot."
For who?
Gizamot.
Okay.
Okay, that's your villain. Number 3, "Only time will tell how we are remembered. Something you no longer have."
Now, Clive Owen said that line. He had to.
I believe so.
Yeah, okay.
We'll just say yes.
All right.
Number 2, "Who is it? We're closed." That's 99 minutes into the movie, by the way. And number 1, this pretty much sums up the movie entirely: "I look forward to your review of the new protocol."
Okay.
There you go.
Last night's.
Don't see it. You
man,
will be bored.
Oh, man, oh, man. All right. And it's a shocker that Morgan Freeman narrates.
Yeah.
He
narrates. And I know he's got second build in the movie. But, you know, if you're going there for Morgan Freeman, you're going to be sorely disappointed, because he's not in the movie very much.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. He's probably out watching a bunch of penguins.
That's
it. All right, here's a little fact about Fast and Furious, the fourth one. They got the gang back together. 2009's Fast and Furious was the first direct sequel to the events of the first film in the saga. Vin Diesel returned full-time after his cameo in Tokyo Drift, but he also picked up the reins as the film's producer, which he would go on to produce the subsequent films in the series as well. It was also the first time in 8 years that Diesel, Walker, and Jordana Brewster had appeared on screen together as their characters since the first film. Though Michelle Rodriguez returned as Letty Ortiz, Diesel is the only original cast member she shares screen time with because her character allegedly dies off screen in the opening sequence. And, of course, they bring her back. And that's another great thing about these movies. Now she's like slowly. It took her two movies to slowly start getting her memory.
Well, she's catching up with the audience.
She's totally. All right, you guys. Hang on, all right?
Yeah.
All right. We got to review some more new movies. And we're talking with Colin. We're talking with Eric. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate Studios on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Monday morning. That means movie reviews. And later on, my dad tells a joke. It's a jokey time. Starting off your week with a laugh with my dad telling a joke. Right now, though, Colin and Eric are with me, and we're reviewing the new movies. And Colin, Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All righty, then. Let's see. Colin, why don't you tell us about While We're Young?
All right. Well, this is the latest from Noah Baumbach, and it stars Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts as a couple in their 40s who are childless and facing a lot of pressure from their friends to have a child. But they have a failed past in that area, so they sort of convince themselves that they love their freedom and their independence. But one day, while Ben Stiller is teaching a class in documentary filmmaking, because that's what he does for a living, sort of, he meets an admirer of his work, played by Adam Driver, and his girlfriend, played by Amanda Seyfried. And, you know, they're a very loose, very hipster-like couple who, you know, they collect vinyl, they only watch movies on VHS, and, you know, he writes with an actual typewriter, you know, that kind of folk. But Stiller and Watts, they like these two very much. They become part of their circle of friends. And soon Adam Driver tries his hand at documentary filmmaking. And then the movie goes into the themes goes from the themes of midlife crisis and into the themes of the ethics of documentary filmmaking and how these two generations here, how they view their work differently through different ethical lenses. So it's a movie that, you know, it feels like one of those kind of Joe Swanberg mumblecore type things. Not so much mumblecore in the style of dialogue. Everything's very written here. But it sort of takes a turn halfway through and becomes about something else, almost in a broadcast news sort of way where you know, how ethical is it to stage something if it's not affecting the overall product at the end of the day. And the movie, I think, is successful in terms of portraying this sort of midlife crisis deal where, you know, people in their 40s, and I can relate to this, you know, start to find themselves having more in common and more of interest with people who are younger than them by at least 10 years. But I think the movie stumbles a little bit towards the end when it gets really high on the whole ethical issue of documentary filmmaking, when it intercuts between this confrontation that Stiller and Driver have together. It intercuts with another documentary filmmaker played by Charles Grodin giving a speech on, you know, a very high-minded speech on documentary filmmaking. And that's when the movie kind of stumbles a little bit and starts to think it's something else, when really it's a really insightful film about midlife crisis. So on that level it works, But I think, you know, towards the end, the movie kind of, you know, loses its way a bit. I love the performances. I think Ben Stiller is really terrific. I think Adam Driver and Amanda Seyfried are wonderfully cast. And, you know, Naomi Watts, you know, very well-written character. I think Baumbach is really good at this sort of thing. I'm sort of on hot and cold on his stuff. I really wasn't crazy about Francis Ha when it came out. It kind of drove me nuts. I felt like if it wasn't in black and white, no one would care. But this, I think this is one of his better works, not a masterpiece by any stretch, but definitely one that, you know, I saw a lot of myself in it, and I thought, you know, Baumbach hit some really interesting notes with the material he's covering. So this is a recommended film.
Yeah, I'm with you. I happen to be a fan. You guys know this. I happen to be a really big fan of Baumbach stuff. And I wasn't, like you guys, I'm not a fan of Francis Ha. I think it might be the worst film he's ever done. But I happen to be a huge fan of many of his other movies. And a lot of his other movies, many of his other movies have made people very uncomfortable. And in my experience have caused walkouts. But this is not one of those movies. This is a much more accessible movie. It's a lot less abrasive than some of the stuff that he's done. And I agree with you. I think Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts, I think everybody in this movie is terrific. The acting is great. And I pretty much, you know, Colin, I think I agree with you word for word on what you said. Because during that sequence that you talked about, the cutting between what's going on with Adam Driver and Stiller and Charles Grodin is, I think, it's an interesting and, I think, screwed up moment in the film. And so the movie takes a leap that I think on paper is sort of brave and really out there and I think kind of cool, but it doesn't really pay off. But ultimately, the stuff between the two couples, the acting and a lot of the writing in this film, I think are terrific. So I'm recommending it. I you know, and like you, you know, Colin, I'm 10 years. How much older than I am than you? Because I'll be
42.
Okay, well, I'm 8 years older than you. So yeah. So this is also a movie that really hit me. It didn't hit me. You know, I always go back to when I realized I was middle aged. Is when I saw Sideways. That was the moment, like when that movie was over, I'm like, well, all right. And it was funny because I remember Eric, like that when that movie came out in 2004, you completely identified with Garden State.
Yeah.
And I completely identified with Sideways.
Yep.
And it was like, oh, okay, yeah, we're 10 years apart.
Right.
That makes sense. But I'm still recommending this movie. I think While We're Young is a good movie and worth seeing. All right, you guys, hang out.
Goodness, Charles Grodin again.
Oh, did you watch Louis last season?
I have. I'm catching up with that last season of Louis and seeing him out there.
Oh, great.
He's this movie. It's like, oh, Charles Grodin is back.
He's phenomenal on Louis. He's hilarious. Oh,
hilarious.
Yeah. All right, you guys, hang on. All right, Colin and Eric are here, and we'll come back and review more movies right here, as we do on Monday mornings on 720 WGN. Nick DiCilio here. How are you, everybody? We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. My friends Colin Suter and Eric Childress are with me to review new movies, and that's what we're doing right now. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Hey, by the way, did you know that technically Fast and Furious, the fourth one, is the fifth movie chronologically because Vin Diesel himself wrote, produced, directed, and starred in a 20-minute short film entitled Los Bandolerellos, starring Dom's gang in the Dominican Republic. The film shows the backstory of how the characters came together leading into the tanker truck heist that begins Fast and Furious 4.
I don't believe this.
Man, there's so much stuff to know about this series.
The Fast and Furious series.
All right.
All I know is I'm never getting to bed tonight.
All right, Eric, tell us about White God.
Okay. Well, this is a really, really unique film about a 13-year-old girl whose parents are separated or divorced. And the mother is sending her to live with her father in Hungary. Her only real sort of friend, the only thing she really connects with, is her dog, Hagen. And she takes Hagen everywhere she goes, even to, a music class, visions of Whiplash, actually, a little bit. obviously, you know, that people do not want the dog around. There are, dog handlers running throughout the city trying to track down strays. They even harass her father a bit when they don't think the dog has got a license or collar or whatever. But the father eventually gets tired of having to deal with the situation, and he cuts the dog loose. And it takes his daughter home, and the dog gets cut loose and basically goes on a little adventure in the city. And while it sounds like the setup for a really cool children's film, this is anything but, yet it is a film very much about childhood and the sort of the transition from childhood to adolescence and maybe adulthood, maybe all too much in the span of just a few days or weeks. The title of the film, the filmmaker has actually said he was inspired a bit by Samuel Fuller's White Dog.
Yeah.
And while this is a film that doesn't really feed upon the sort of the racial element that that film does, there is an element of sort of danger and where the dog gets put into the wrong hands of somebody that you could actually see, you know, the dog actually becoming, you know, that dog from White Dog in a way. And the girl Lily is kind of going on her own little adventure too. Now without this dog, her friend with her, she's also sort of getting involved with the wrong people, or at least the wrong situations. And so you sort of see this sort of this parallel story between this young girl and this dog of hers, leading very different lives than they probably should be. And then the movie in the third act takes a very, very fascinating turn, and it actually becomes this really crazy revenge tale told in many ways from the dog's perspective. And so the
what?
Movie, yes. Yeah. You haven't seen this, Nick?
No, I haven't.
Oh, dude. You're going to want to see this movie because it really is quite extraordinary. It's one of the more unique dog films I've ever seen. I mean, it sounds like Homeward Bound, but it, you know, it, like you said, it takes this turn where let's just say, I mean, if you see the poster, or if you see any stills from this movie, you see sort of images of rampaging dogs running through the streets of Hungary, and that's how the movie actually begins, with this sort of this either dream sequence or flash forward to events that are later going to happen later. Obviously, I don't want to spoil too much about the movie, but it takes such a turn, and it leads to some beautiful imagery, some crazy violence, ultimately, it's ultimately kind of a really sad tale of where this girl and her dog are going to sort of intersect in their lives, at this point in their lives. It's really one of the more unique films I've seen in some time. Certainly one of the best films I've seen this year so far. It's definitely worth checking out.
Okay. It's at the Music Box, by the way, if you're if you're interested in seeing it. It's called White God. All right, cool. All right, Colin, why don't you tell us about Woman in Gold?
All right. Well, this is based on a true story about a woman named Maria Altman, that's played by Helen Mirren, a Jewish woman whose family is responsible, her heritage is responsible for these famous Woman in Gold paintings. Well, these paintings were seized by the Nazis during the occupation and have been in Austria ever since. And now she, you know, about 50, 60 years later, she wants to reclaim them and, you know, what is rightfully hers. But in order to do so, she has to endure a long court battle And for that, she hires Ryan Reynolds, who is an attorney. And, of course, that as often goes in these kinds of stories, has little experience in these kinds of matters. But he takes her case anyway, and no surprise, the Austrian government is not keen on letting these paintings go anytime soon, and they do everything they can to block their efforts. So the movie spans quite a few years in this journey of trying to get these paintings back. The movie also shifts back and forth between present day and back during World War II when Maria was younger and the Nazis took over with these paintings. So this is one of those films that really tries to get by on the fact that it's based on a true story and doesn't really do much to bring anything to light or do anything, stylistically interesting with the story. So much so that it makes Imitation Game look like a real experimental art house piece.
Oh, God.
So, I mean, this is about as generic a Weinstein product as you're going to get. It's basically it wants to be Philomena with the relationship between Reynolds and Helen Mirren. Helen Mirren is your typical feisty, no nonsense kind of person.
Snarky, funny,
and Ryan Reynolds is trying to pass himself off, as nebbish kind of lawyer guy. And it's like, dude, you're Ryan Reynolds. You're like one of the hottest guys on the planet. take the glasses off and own up to it. You're not fooling anyone. And Katie Holmes plays his wife, and she's basically the dramatic version of the one-dimensional female character in a male-driven comedy.
Okay.
The drama version of that. One of my favorite SNL characters.
Absolutely.
Right? Every time. This is a movie that is just, it wouldn't pass them for, even during Oscar season, it would get ignored, even though it's that kind of a movie. But a very generic version of that kind of movie. So, everyone's just kind of phoning it in here.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll take a break and we'll come back and review the greatest movie ever made. hang on, you guys.
Okay.
And more facts about the Fast and the Furious series coming up. And we're going to review Furious 7 coming up after the break. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate Studios. Every Monday morning, we review the new movies with Colin and Eric from efilmcritic.com and rogerebert.com. And let's welcome Colin and Eric back. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Hey, by the way, in Fast 5... prior to creating the fifth movie in the franchise, Vin Diesel reached out to fans on his official Facebook page asking for potential ideas of where the story could go, and someone suggested writing a role for The Rock as the bad guy. During the writing phase, the filmmakers reached out to Johnson to play Hobbs. He was the only choice to play the role, and he agreed to sign on, and the rest is social networking history. So we have Facebook to thank for The Rock being in the series.
The series is making more and more sense.
Am I enlightening you guys a little bit more into the genius of this franchise?
All except the genius part, but okay.
All right, Eric, tell us about Furious 7.
Okay. Well, if you've been following Nick's fun facts tonight, you pretty much know where we are up to date in this series. Our heroes have conquered the Luke Evans bad guy from the sixth movie, has put him in a hospital. Apparently, he's still alive. And his big bad brother, an ex-Special Forces guy played by Jason Statham, has vowed revenge on our heroes. And his first step is to basically destroy the entire hospital where his brother is receiving care. Weirdest start to a revenge angle I've ever seen in a movie ever. But, so he is hunting down our heroes. If you saw Fast, the last movie, whatever it was called, you know that he's already taken out at least one of our members of our family.
He took out the Tokyo Drift dude.
Yeah, he went back into the third movie, time traveled, and took out Han. And he has returned, and he's vowing revenge against everyone else. So while they're on the run, they get picked up by another sort of shadowy government figure played by Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
Who has an endless supply of exposition and beer. And
yes, and it's like, he keeps telling Vin Diesel to not drink Corona.
Yes,
which
is actually a funny, really funny running joke.
It's hilarious.
But so Kurt Russell is basically tells Vin Diesel.
By the way, yeah. I'm sorry. Do you know Kurt Russell's name, his character name on the credits officially?
It's Mr. Nobody.
Mr. Nobody.
Yeah, that's what he calls himself. Yeah. So Mr. Nobody gets our family of heroes together to hunt down a hacker played by Natalie Emmanuel from Game of Thrones who has invented some device.
Oh, that's where she's from?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
She's one of Khaleesi's okay. Lady friends. She's invented this device that can basically track anyone in the world. I guess she watched The Dark Knight. And she... if they can find her and protect her from a warlord played by Jaimin Hunsu, they can get the device from her and track down Jason Statham, so they know basically when he's coming.
God's Eye, by the way, is the name of the device.
Yes, yeah. There you go. which seems like a really ridiculous plan, considering Jason Statham shows up wherever they're at. So it doesn't really they don't really need anything to track him with. We're getting into a lot of plot heavy stuff here. The bottom line is that this is the first film in the franchise that finally won me over. And one of the reasons it did that is because this movie actually has a really kind of furious pace to it. And it was directed by James Wan. Did the first Saw movie, The Conjuring, Insidious, Death Sentence, which is more proof that he could do a fantastic
Death Sentence, by the way, one of the most criminally underrated movies ever.
I agree.
A great movie.
Yeah, and that was a movie that showed how good he could be at shooting an actual action sequence.
Yeah, yeah.
And as crazy as these action sequences get, they're done with a lot of style. They're done with a terrific amount of some terrific editing, really. Just enough space to give you sort of geography on where everything is. Because of that furious pace that I mentioned, that you kind of win yourself over. There's less talking in the, most of the talking is still exposition anyway, when they're not talking about family, of course. and the action sequences are fairly well done, and there's a lot of them. And it all leads up to a really crazy, 30-minute climax. With all the heroes coming together, and The Rock is shooting down helicopters and stuff, and it's just it's crazy, and it all leads up to obviously a really sort of nice tribute to Paul Walker, who obviously passed away while he was in the middle of filming this. I think there are a couple sloppy transitions here and there, mostly in trying to bring the Tokyo Drift thing into the timeline.
Right.
Is really kind of sloppily done, but they did what they could. But I think that they kind of pull off a seamless transition. What could have been a really difficult, obviously was a very difficult thing in losing one of their primary cast members.
Yeah.
And I think they, whatever you think about Paul Walker and his career or whatever, he gets the send off on the series that I suppose he deserves. And it was, I didn't quite get misty eyed the way some people.
I did.
Have.
I did.
I know you did.
I absolutely did at the end of this movie. Yeah.
But I liked it. I kind of sat there in the theater going, that's really kind of nice. That's what him and his fans really.
By the way, I was in a theater full of people who were sniffling and blowing their nose. I'm not kidding.
That's okay. Okay, but bottom line is, I finally liked one of these movies.
Oh man!
And
all right.
So thank you, James Wan.
Okay. All right, Colin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with this series. I think I've liked a couple of them, but I can't really remember which ones I did, which ones I didn't, because they all kind of run together to me.
They do. You know what, and Colin, and that's absolutely true, and I love these movies, and I can't tell you which one is which.
Right.
Yeah. All I know is I love them.
After Tokyo Drift, you can tell me, remember, this is the car chase scene with the safe. I don't know what one that is. Okay.
That's five.
I'm sure I saw
one. That's Fast Five.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I remember, I think I liked the first one, but I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that I saw it at a drive-in, which is where you're supposed to see it.
Oh, yeah.
So, and then after that, I think I liked another one of them. Eric, you know, spent a lot of time on the plot on this one, which if you handed it over to me, I don't think I would have spent nearly as much time because I don't remember the plot to this thing. Because, like Eric said, it is so furious. It really lives up to its title. I mean, a lot of the other movies I've liked, you know, an action scene here and there in between a lot of long, slow stretches of expository dialogue and Vin Diesel talking about family, which I couldn't care less about. But this movie does not have that problem at all. It's basically three action scenes, three or maybe four really big, long action scenes that really deliver the goods and are edited at such a pace that, you know, I know who the good guys are. I know who the bad guys are. I don't really care about this hacker plot. I don't really care what Jason Statham's agenda is. I don't care about any of that stuff. But, man, did I have a good time watching this movie just for the sheer insanity of it all. And I'm so glad that I didn't see a trailer for it beforehand, because there's a skydiving sequence in this movie that really set me on edge. It was really hard to watch just the idea of what these guys willingly do in this scene. I know,
and that's like the opening sequence of the movie too.
Just like, oh, we're starting here.
What?
Oh, okay. Yeah. And everybody's on board with this. This is our plan. You can pay me enough. But, man, it's so much fun to watch just the sort of go for broke attitude that I think, you know, was in the other movies in sort of fits and starts, but is really on display here. This is, and by the way, you know, you do not have to have seen all six Fast and the Furious to enjoy this one.
No.
You can go into this one cold, not remembering what the hell happened in the last one or where they left off, and just go in and just have a good time and enjoy yourself. And I will say, while the Paul Walker send-off is really nice and is very appropriate, it is going to play a little weirdly, you know, say 50 years down the road when somebody watches these things not knowing that he died. And going,
they try to incorporate it into the plot at the end.
That's not a criticism. It's just an observation. This is a fun movie that people should just go and enjoy.
Yeah, I don't even know. You guys know what I think.
Yeah.
This movie rules the planet. I was beside myself during this entire movie. I think James Wan did a great job, and I think Justin Lin's a great director too, and I love these movies very much, and they're stupid, and unapologetically, I love the stupidity of these movies and how ridiculous they've gotten. You know, The Rock is in the movie for about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, he's in the beginning, and then they throw him in a hospital, and then he comes back at the end. But the stuff he does during the last 15 minutes of the movie is unbelievably awesome.
Yeah.
And he's got the killer lines. They gave The Rock, like, the killer lines of dialogue in this movie. The action sequences in this movie are unbelievable. I have to tell you, the scene in Dubai with the three skyscrapers and the car is one of the greatest action sequence. I was jumping up and down like a monkey in my seat during that sequence. I lost my mind during that. I've never seen anything that insane. Here's the thing that I keep thinking about when I watch these stupid movies is that they're like brain dead Bond movies. You know what I mean? Like it's like if you leave your brain at the door, because the Bond movies have gotten smarter.
Yes.
You know, since Sam Mendes took over and stuff, and the next one's probably going to be like sort of really brilliant and cerebral. Meanwhile, these movies up the ante of the kind of stuff that you would see in a James Bond movie in terms of action sequences and stunts, but they're really stupid.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I loved it. I loved it. So, all right, you guys, what do we got next week?
Not much. We got a Nicholas Sparks movie.
Oh, God. All right, you guys. Eric, Colin, thank you guys so much.
Thanks, man.
And we'll talk to you next week.
All right.
We'll see you later. There you go. There's Colin. There's Eric. Furious 7, greatest movie ever. All right, we'll take a break. It's Nick DiGilio on WGN.
I want money. $720 bucks richer, you are my friend.
That's what I want.
You know how this works. Steve Cochran in the morning at 720 tells you when the money clip is going to be played, and you're caller 72. After you hear the money clip, you're a winner. Thanks a lot for listening and calling.
Thank you so much.
What do you need money for this spring? We've got it. $720 bucks every weekday. Win all this week. Only on the Money Clip Station, 720 WGN.
The Chicago Tribune's Eric Zorn explains why Chicago's property taxes may be too low.